I'm telling you, whenever I end up going back on the road, which I hope is relatively soon, but probably won't be for this year's Australian Open, I can tell you, whenever I head back on the road to travel, my pillow is coming with me. It's totally changed the way I sleep. Totally. I mean, I'm just so much more comfortable, relaxed. I don't know what it is. Getting a little older, I feel like I need more sleep. I had COVID back in March. I feel like I've been sleeping like 9-10 hours a night. But I'll tell you, since I got my pillow, and thanks to my friends there for supporting this podcast and sending me the stuff, absolutely changed my life. You got to try it. My Pillow. There's an absolute plethora of stuff you can order on the site. Okay, all different My Pillow products. I got the mattress top. I got, as I said, some of the towels. The pillows are off the charts. If you got a pet, you'll love that too. So here's the number to call. 800-875-1023. That's 800-875-1023. And use the promo code COURT.
This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe. Now, here's Patrick McEnroe.
All right, time for another edition of Holding Court, everyone. This man and I have been going back and forth for quite some time, trying to land him on my podcast. He's been nice enough to agree to do it. His background, yeah, he's been in tennis. He's been in college hoops. He's been in NBA. He's a journalist for many, many years, written for many publications, including the New York Times, including for Forbes. He's a sort of the man around the New York City area. So I've known Adam Zagore, I'm talking about, for many, many years. But you've always loved tennis, Adam. So tell me a little bit about how you got into tennis yourself personally. And then obviously I know it's been part of what you do on your blog and what you've done in your writing career as well.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much, Patrick, for having me on. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you. You do great work on ESPN and with your podcast. I grew up like an hour north of New York City in Westchester County in Croton-on-Hudson, and my father, who's now 92, was a big tennis player and introduced me to the sport. And I played my whole childhood. I used to hit with my dad every weekday night at the local hard courts across from the high school. And at that time when I was 10, 11 years old, I was also a huge Johnny Mac fan, like a lot of people, like
right.
Guys like, Wayne Gretzky and, guys like that. I know we're also, Steve Nash, a big Johnny Mac, Bjorn Borg fan.
Now, Nash, of course, is the coach of the Brooklyn Nets. By the way, I don't mean to interrupt your story because this is what this is about, but Steve Nash has gotten super into tennis. Later in his life, he said, just like late in his playing career, his basketball career. So I had him on with Dirk Nowitzki when I first started the podcast way back. But now that he's in New York, I'm going to have to get him solo. And the other thing I've been waiting to do, Adam, with him is hit some balls, because apparently he's like obsessed with tennis now.
Well, I think he's a little busy right now because he's training camp with the Nets, but you could get him in the summer. I've been on some Zoom calls with him talking about Kevin Durant and Kyrie. But, yeah, just to kind of finish that real quickly, as a kid, in my mind, I was sort of watching all these epic, McEnroe Borg, Jimmy Connors matches on TV, and I would cut out every New York Times article that had, Johnny Mac in it, put it on my wall in my bedroom. And in 1979, when I was 10, my father won the town tennis tournament in singles and doubles. So he came home with these two trophies that were about as tall as your waist is right now. So in my mind, kind of my dad, was conflated in this tennis world with like your brother and Borg as these sort of larger than life tennis heroes.
Very interesting. And of course, Westchester County, just a little bit north of where I am. I live in Bronxville now. And so I moved out of the city a couple of years ago. Now, I know that you got a place down on the Jersey Shore because you and I text back and forth during the pandemic. And I'm very impressed, Adam, that even as the weather's turning a bit chilly, you're still getting out there. You're sending me pictures of, you on some courts down there by the Jersey Shore, actually still playing tennis like in the 40s.
Yeah, we were talking about that. I played doubles yesterday morning, Sunday morning, in Cape May at 9:30 in the morning. I think it was about 37 or 39 degrees. You know, when I stepped on the court, you're wearing three layers. I played doubles with a guy who said he played first singles at a Division II school in New Hampshire.
Okay.
You know, and now he's like 60 or something, but he's still, you can tell he knows how to play doubles. He's good. But these people are, they're hardy down here, man. They play year round. You know, like you said before, if as long as it's sort of 40 or above, mm-hmm. and not too windy, you know, not too windy, you could play outdoors.
Well, you gotta suck it up and tough it out. And but like you said, if it's I got my first little taste of paddle tennis, which is played in sort of a cage, is popular in Westchester and Connecticut, and a lot of ex tennis guys play it as well. And yeah. I must say it was pretty cool. I played, you know, you'd play at night and it's a little cooler. I played with my brother up in Connecticut, my famous brother. Well, he's famous in Connecticut, my brother Mark. And he plays a mean paddle game. So we play, it took me about half a set to sort of figure it out, but it got a good sweat going, Adam. So, you know, you can get that in tennis, although tennis, you don't, you know, paddles is a little quicker. It's almost like a, you know, it's like a mini tennis court. But if you can break a sweat playing tennis in the 40s or 50s, you're doing something right.
Yeah. Are you worried the paddle ball is going to mess up your tennis at all or not?
At this stage in my career, Adam, I'm not worried about that at all. No, maybe back in the day, I know you used to play a lot of squash and racquetball. I used to think about that when I was a legit tennis player, meaning playing for money, and that was my career. I used to think, well, maybe I shouldn't, you know, I dabbled in squash, a little bit of racquetball, but the swing was so different that I wouldn't play it that much. Used to play a ton of ping pong growing up.
Ping pong is awesome. Yeah. We got to play some ping pong.
Yeah, my brother and I used to play a lot. In fact, that was one of the only games when I was little that I could actually beat my brother once in a while. And we grew up in Douglaston in Queens, so we lived in a house and we had a garage that was in the basement downstairs, and we put the ping pong table in the garage so we could play during the winter. And sure. Suffice to say, Adam, that there were a lot of masking tape rolls because we would throw the paddles against the wall, you know, when we got pissed, especially my older brother, John, and we'd have to rewrap the handles with the masking tape. And my dad would yell out, what the hell are you doing down there? So that was my history in playing ping pong as a kid. Now, I certainly wasn't a legit ping pong player, but we used to do that for fun, just like we do these other sports. And so did you keep playing tennis as you got to be a little, you know, like into your teenage years?
Basically, Patrick, I have played tennis my whole life. I went through a big ultimate frisbee phase of my life for, you know, 25, 30 years. I played in the Nationals, played in the semifinals of Nationals with a team from New York, and the finals of Masters Nationals with a team from New York. And I think it was Bo Jackson or Deion Sanders had a line once that football was their wife. One of them said football was their wife and baseball was their girlfriend.
So right.
I think for a long time for me, it was, you know, ultimate was my wife and tennis was my girlfriend.
And
before I had an actual wife.
Amazing, because I mean, how did you get into ultimate? I know you write about it on your blog, Zags blog, by the way. You can check it out, ZAGSblog.com, and you can find all Adam's stuff, his articles from the Times, from college hoops, from recruiting, tennis. But tell me how you got into that, because if you did that well, you must have some speed, Adam, or you must have had some speed.
I had some, yeah. I mean, you know, I went to Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, which is, you know, kind of a small liberal arts, you know, known as a bit of a hippie school. And I actually went to meet with the tennis coach there when I first got there. And, you know, I don't know if we had a falling out or whatever, but it wasn't really my scene. And I was sort of, you know, anxious to play a sport, even though I lived in this like super hippie dorm where most of the kids weren't playing sports. And I felt like I was missing something. And then eventually I kind of fell in with the guys on the ultimate team, including one guy who was a year older than me from my high school. And it was great because, you know, ultimate, I know people sort of make fun of it still, but requires a lot of endurance. It's a lot of running, a lot of speed. And I, you know, I played in college and I played for club teams. and I've, you know, played my whole life to the point where now I'm on a great Grand Masters team. Which
oh, really?
50
wow.
50 and over.
That's intense. So, yeah.
Yeah, we actually won a world championship in Florida in 2018. So, you know, if you had told me when I was 20 at Wesleyan that I'd be playing something called Grand Masters Ultimate, I would have laughed.
In your 50s with a wife and a couple kids, right? That's pretty impressive.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And that's, so tell me.
But, you know, now that I'm older, you know, I sort of had to move into tennis more.
Well, tennis is, I mean, and like we said, like paddle tennis, which I just tried out, and also pickleball, which is getting to be sort of popular. I tried that for the first time, which is cool. I mean, obviously, playing doubles at our age is a little better because you don't have to cover as much court, but those other games are similar. So you see a lot of guys our age, you know, getting to be in their 50s and up. And who played competitively at some level as a tennis player, you know, getting into those other sports. All right, let's move a little bit to your professional life, which is in journalism and writing and how you got started in that. And I know you often come to me when you've got, you know, some tennis stuff that you've written about. I know that's one of the things you do. You've mostly done a lot of college hoops and NBA hoops, but tell me how that started for you and what was the bug that got you going there?
Yeah, I mean, I think just at a certain point, like most young people, you know, I was looking for something to do. I never wanted to work in an office, you know, 9 to 5 and be a lawyer or do insurance. None of that stuff appealed to me. And at a certain point, it occurred to me that I could get paid to write about sports. You know, I think the first real thing I had was sort of freelance covering a high school basketball team in Ridgewood, Connecticut, Ridgewood Press. And the editor sent me out to cover a game. And I didn't know anything about journalism. I didn't know you were supposed to really interview the players after the game. So I think that the first story I wrote, I just wrote a story off the game. I didn't interview the players. I didn't know you could really talk to them. You know, and like everyone else, I learned. I went to Columbia Journalism School with our friend Jane McManus, classmate of mine at Columbia. And I got my first gig at the Star Ledger, an internship out of that. And then, you know, I spent 10 or 12 years in newspapers and, eventually, a big thing that happened was while I was at the Herald News and the Bergen Record in New Jersey,
right,
in the late 90s, they started these things called blogs, which at the time, everyone, you know, it was kind of a new thing. And they said, hey, we're going to give you this blog. What do you want to call it? And I used to have a column in the Ultimate Frisbee newsletter called Zag's Rag.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, we'll call this Zag's Blog. And, you know, out of that, I started covering a lot of high school basketball recruiting, college basketball, and that, you know, over the years sort of morphed into covering the Big East and covering national college basketball. And, you know, now I sort of, that's probably 50 to 60% of what I do. And then tennis is maybe 25% and NBA is 25%. So it's a little bit of everything.
It's a little bit of a mishmash. And how would you say that your world, this world, I mean, obviously, you've had to adapt over the years. You've worked in many different places. But how would you say, let's start with A, just the internet in general, because like you said, the blog sort of, you know, came up. And now, of course, everybody's on social media to some level. But how did that change what's happened in your world, in the journalism world? And then, of course, you know, let's get to the pandemic and how things have changed there with all of us doing Zooms. I mean, I started my podcast because of it. Every, you know, different people I've asked to do their podcast. Oh, do I have to do your podcast? Everybody does a podcast now. It's like everybody can get their opinion out. But how has that changed the world of the professional world of journalism in your experience?
Yeah, well, great question. You know, in answer to the first question, I would say that, you know, the internet in a lot of ways, you know, hurt newspapers. I think everyone knows that by now that, you know, I don't know, you know, your kids, my kids, they don't really read a newspaper in print. They don't hold it in their hands.
Right.
They, you know, everyone gets their news on the internet. So that, you know, cost a lot of jobs in the newspaper and the print industry. You know, a lot of my friends were furloughed or let go.
And it's still and it's still costing jobs, right? I mean, in that industry.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, the Daily News, you know, used to have a very robust sports department. They let go almost all their sports department, you know, a couple of years ago. You know, ESPN's had layoffs. So, you know, a lot of companies have had layoffs. So that's, you know, it's been tough. Now, the flip side of it, and also another big change is, like, in the old days, if I worked at, say, the Star Ledger and I broke a story that, you know, Patrick McEnroe was committing to Stanford,
right,
and you gave me an exclusive interview,
right,
that I could put in my paper on Saturday,
mm-hmm,
and I beat the New York Post or the Daily News, you know, they would have to read about it in the paper Saturday, you know, Patrick McEnroe committed to Stanford, and they'd have to wait to get it in the newspaper, you know, Sunday or Monday,
right,
after they got their own interview with you. So there was, you really kind of get a real satisfaction of, you know, I'm a competitive guy, journalists are competitive, like, hey, I beat these guys on this Patrick McEnroe story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, Woj breaks the big, you know, Woj bomb about James Harden or,
right,
or, you know, or whatever on the internet, and within 2 minutes or 5 minutes, you know, there's 10 or 20 stories on websites all around the world who've embedded his tweet, you know, taken the news, put up a headline, and they're getting the internet traffic off of news he's made.
Right, right.
You know, or news I make or news any reporter makes.
And so then the only way those sites can monetize that is by basically getting advertisers, correct?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not in the advertising world, but the whole business is now about really clicks and monetizing internet traffic, which is a whole another world. But, you know, I've been able sort of, and I think most journalists, you know, you have to, first of all, you have to be responsible and reputable in your information. You
mm-hmm.
have to make sure your information's correct.
Right.
And there's a real pressure now to get stuff out first. And if you're first and you're wrong, you know, that doesn't help you. So I think, you know, there's still a place for journalists to tell good stories and break news and have access to, you know, people that everyone else doesn't. But, you know, there's a whole world of dudes now that just sit in their basement or sit in an office and have never interviewed, you know, Patrick or John McEnroe or mm-hmm. Carmelo Anthony. And they just take other people's tweets or information and write, you know, quote unquote stories off of that.
Yeah. And if they're really good at sort of manipulating the information or creating videos or coming up with, you know, something that sort of catches people's attention, then that's what gets them the clicks, right? And that gets them, at the end of the day, they can make a living doing that, right?
Yeah, and the average consumer, you know, doesn't really care
mm-hmm.
who broke. They don't care which reporter broke the news. They just want to read about it. So, you know, again, it's this whole business of search engine optimization and, you know, who can get the most clicks. I mean, you know, obviously someone like Woj is unique in that he's the clear preeminent leader on NBA news in his industry. And so people know when he produces news, but most people don't really, you know, give a darn where the news comes from. They just want it.
So speaking of the news, and we briefly brought up the Brooklyn Nets, but obviously with Durant and Kyrie and now Steve Nash as the new coach, I was actually just looking at, sort of the preseason, you know, some predictions and I think a couple sites had Brooklyn, like, you know, with a decent chance to go at least to get to the finals. I know the Lakers will still be the favorite, but where do you, I mean, you know, on the inside of what you know, as much as you can be during these times, what do you make of where the Nets can go this year?
Yeah, it's interesting because you look at all the odds, the Vegas odds, you know, the Lakers are clearly the number one
right.
favorite to repeat. They have, you know, they have LeBron and Anthony Davis. And then they added some other nice pieces, Dennis Schroeder, Montrezl Harrell. So I think they're clearly the favorite. The Bucks and Giannis are generally the number two favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of sites have the Nets as the third favorite, which is, you know, considering they have Kevin Durant and Kyrie and a lot of supporting pieces, that's not that surprising. But this team has never played together.
Right.
You know, KD hasn't played a single game with them. He hasn't played with Kyrie. They're both coming off injuries. KD hasn't played a game in like 560 days or something.
Yeah, so, but it's amazing how in basketball, I mean, if you have the best player, obviously if you're LeBron or, you know, if Durant does come back healthy, he's, you know, arguably the second best, maybe, you know, certainly the best scorer, maybe the best all around player along with LeBron. It's amazing how much when you, if you have that one guy and then you have a good, really great second guy, and then you have the pieces, that basically it's not that surprising to me as someone that doesn't follow it as closely as you do, that they would put them that high, because it is, you know, one player really can make that much of a difference to me more than any other in any other sport as far as the team sports go.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one thing I've always loved about basketball as opposed to football, Patrick, is, you know, one or two guys can dramatically change the
right
the fortunes of a team. You know, I've been on these Zoom calls with Steve Nash and the Nets players for the past week, and you know, one interesting thing is kind of the whole load management question with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said Kyrie and KD, you know, probably won't play all 72 games. So it's like, how many games will they play? How many will he rest them? You know, everybody wants to see how Durant looks when he comes back. And, you know, we'll just kind of have to see how he adapts and how his body holds up. You know, the other flip side of that story is that the Nets have a chance here in New York, Patrick, to sort of overtake the Knicks.
From a playing standpoint, that doesn't say a lot, but I get your point. You know, being a longtime Knicks fan that I've always been, obviously the Knicks rule the roost in New York. But I mean, as far as what they're putting out on the court, it's just been pitiful, absolutely pitiful.
Yeah, it's been two decades. I have a lot of friends like you do who are Knicks fans, and look, let's be frank. Some people want the owner to sell the team, and they don't think the team will ever, you know, reverse its curse until he sells the team. And it's going to be weird this year because there won't be fans at the game, so you won't really have a sense of the buzz around the team. But you know, clearly there's a lot of expectation and hype around the Nets, and they're expected to be more relevant than the Knicks. You know, and then obviously another huge NBA storyline right now, Patrick, is James Harden.
Right,
what's going to happen with him? You know, he hasn't been in Rockets training camp the past couple days. He was apparently at a rapper's birthday event.
At a strip club, right?
Yeah. So, you know, everybody sort of wants to know what's going to happen there. Is he going to force his way out, force a trade? Will he end up with the Nets? If he does end up with the Nets, how does that, you know, manufacture itself when you have Kyrie, KD, and James Harden?
Yeah, there's only one ball, guys. That could be a little difficult. Then they all like to shoot, those guys, all three of them.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's a lot of interesting questions going into the season.
All right, let me get your take on tennis, because I'm happy to hear you say like 25% of what you do and where you get your income or the writing you do is about tennis, because I know you and I stay in touch on that. I love your stuff that you put out mostly on Forbes online. But, you know, the Australian Open, I did a little solo pod a little bit earlier, talked just a little bit about, you know, the way things are changing, the dynamic of the start time a couple weeks later, the 2-week quarantine for the players, although now they'll be able to at least practice for 4 or 5 hours a day. What's your take on sort of, you know, how tennis A has handled the pandemic and, you know, the tournament schedule that it was able to have, including, of course, the U.S. Open, which I was lucky enough to be there, but also looking ahead to next year. How do you think tennis has handled it when you compare it to the other sports that you cover, hoops, you know, pro hoops and college hoops, for example?
Yeah, well, first of all, again, I'll just say that I think you and your colleague, you know, Brad Gilbert and, you know, Renee Stubbs and all the folks at ESPN do a great job.
Thank you.
And the Tennis Channel guys as well, Andy Roddick and Jim Courier and those guys. And I, you know, I'm always interested when one of you sort of comments on the state of the GOAT race and who's going to wind up with the most majors all the time.
I think
everyone's sort of fascinated by that conversation. You know, as far as the schedule, I think they did the best they could. I mean, you know, they shut down, they canceled Indian Wells last year, which was the first major sporting event in the U.S. to be canceled.
Amazing, right? Because I remember literally I was about to get on a plane to go out there, and I remember going on the radio show with our buddy, the Mad Dog, Chris Russo, who, of course, is a huge radio personality, if anyone doesn't know him. but also a big tennis fan. And he was going on and on about how could they cancel Indian Wells. And I think the NBA had just had maybe the first game that got canceled. And he said, what are we going to do? He went on this unbelievable rant saying that they're going to shut everything down. And I called him, actually, and I said, yeah, I think that's actually exactly what's going to happen. He's like, you can't just shut everything down. And then lo and behold, he had to come back a couple days later and said, yeah, I guess that is where we're going. But Indian Wells was like really the first event, big time of sporting event in this country to shut down, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, look, I was at the Big East tournament that Wednesday, I guess, March 10th.
Yep.
I was also at an Allman Brothers tribute concert at the Garden on March 9th. I think that's when I got COVID sometime in those 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then I come home that whatever that Wednesday was, the 11th or whenever the night the NBA canceled.
Right.
And I think it really hit home for everybody, like, holy cow, they're shutting the NBA down.
Right.
And around that same time, they canceled Indian Wells. And people were, you know, that's when it really hit home for a lot of people.
Well,
now here we are. And it sounds like, you know, according to our buddy John Wertheim and other people, they're probably not going to have Indian Wells again this year, right?
Well, I've heard through my sources, okay, which I can't divulge, that there's still talk going on. I believe that they want to hold the tournament for sure. Obviously, the question is, will there be any fans at all?
Right.
But I think they really want the tournament to take place, and if it means that, you know, I think they would do it without fans if they could, is the point. I mean, last year they obviously was too quick; there was no way they could pull it off. But I think this year the intent, at least, is to have the event happen. Of course, the Australian Open, Adam, will be a couple of weeks later than normal. Unfortunately, I will not be going to the Australian Open as I've done every year since 1991, which was actually, believe it or not, the year I made the semifinals there. Give myself a little plug. But I've been going there every year to either play or broadcast. And I have to tell you, traveling all over the world, this is my plug for my first sponsor, Adam, okay? MyPillow is sponsoring my podcast. And let me tell you something. You know this from traveling, right? What's the most important thing for you when you go check into a hotel? What's the single most important thing, number one?
You want to be comfortable in your bed with your pillow.
Well, the pillow, yeah. Well, you're a good man. I would say clean is number one, probably. We want it to be clean. But number two is, how comfortable is the bed and the pillow? And for me, traveling like I have for, you know, 40 years playing tennis, I always get bummed when I get like the soft pillow. So I went to MyPillow when they said they were going to sponsor me. I went to the website. I ordered the MyPillow. I ordered the medium version, the king size version. I mean, it's changed my life. The last week, it's been unbelievable. I've been sleeping with them. You can wash them. You can put them in the dryer. They don't go flat. You can wash them and dry them as many times as you want. Of course, they're all made in the USA. You've got to check these out. Premium MyPillows right now. Okay, Adam, check this out. You get the premium MyPillow, normally $69.98. Holiday special, $29.98. That's $40 off. Okay?
Quite a deal.
So you're talking about a deal, okay, at this holiday time. Go get the premium MyPillow. Buy it now. Old Mike will extend his 60-day money-back guarantee to March 1st. 2021. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square. You'll find all these other amazing things. By the way, do you have a pet, Adam?
We have a 2-year-old dog named Daphne.
Okay, so I have a dog named Pepper. He's a Yorkie, so he's small. But you can buy a large or a medium or a small pet pillow. So I bought one for my dog. Oh, my God, my three daughters love it. Oh, it's so cute. Get the thing. So I got that. I got some towels. I got the robe. I got the extra sheets for the bed. Phenomenal. So here's the number to call. You ready? MyPillow. Get anything you want. Go to the website. Go 1-800-875-1023. That's 1-800-875-1023. And, of course, you've got to use the promo code COURT, as in holding court, which is what I'm doing right now with the one and only Adam Zagoria. So when we look, I want to get a little bit from you, Adam, too, on college hoops, because I love hoops. Obviously, the college season, you know, I guess like the football season, it's going to be touch and go game after even the game, the big showdown, Gonzaga and Baylor got canceled, what, like an hour before the game. They're 1-2 in the country, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the coaches, Scott Drew and Mark Few, were, you know, courtside in their mask, kind of ready to go, and the game was canceled because Gonzaga had some positive tests last week, and now they're shut down, you know, until December 14th. They canceled four games. So, you know, I mean, what's really weird about the college season is you've got some teams, Patrick, like Xavier, has played six already, and then you have teams like Manhattan, coached by our guy Steve Masiello, a former
New
York Knicks ball boy with Rick Pitino. They haven't played a single game.
Unbelievable. You know, it's crazy.
A couple schools like DePaul and Temple and Manhattan haven't played a single game, and then you have other schools that have played five or six.
And Pitino's a coach up here by me now, right?
Rick is I'm on Zoom calls with him a couple times a week. He's coaching at Iona.
And how's that working out so far? How they look?
They lost to Seton Hall in their opener at Seton Hall. Then they went and beat up on Hofstra the other day, and they have a kid named Isaiah Ross, who scored 33 points against Hofstra in that game.
Wow.
And, you know, it's interesting to see Rick. You know, you're so used to seeing him coach at Kentucky and Louisville in these big-time programs. You know, obviously he had his off-court issues, and, you know, he was fired at Louisville in 2017. That's not a secret. But he took this job because he said it reminds him of Providence, you know, small Catholic school.
Where he had an unbelievable run. Didn't he get him the Final Four there?
Final Four with Billy D, Billy Donovan as the point guard. And so, you know, he speaks very fondly about Providence and how walking around the Iona campus reminds him of that. And he says he's going to coach at Iona for 5, 6, 7 years. He believes they can be kind of the Gonzaga or the St. Mary's of the Northeast.
Okay.
You know, a sleeping giant. And he's, you know, he actually had a pretty funny, interesting story about how he brought in 8 new recruits this year, including a kid from Nigeria, a couple overseas kids, kids from around the U.S. And he said COVID actually helped them in recruiting because these kids weren't able to visit other campuses. They committed because it was Rick Pitino and they didn't know anything about Iona or New Rochelle, New York, but they committed because of him. And if it hadn't been for COVID, you know, they could have visited other campuses and gone somewhere else.
Interesting. Well, listen, you know, when this whole thing ends, we might have to go over to, you know, Iona's like 10 minutes away from me. So I'm going to have to go over there and actually check out a game. You and me, we'll play some tennis. Okay. Maybe by the spring, we can get the vaccine, like the college season. It'll be March Madness may become like May Madness. Who the heck knows?
And that's what Pitino wants.
Yeah, we could go hit some balls together, and then we can go watch a game.
Yeah, and we'll have to cap off the night by going out for Italian food with Rick.
Now you're talking, man. You're talking. Adam Zagoria, man, it's been a real pleasure. This, like, flew by.
Let me just finish real quick on the college hoop.
Yes, please.
You know, I mean, look, there was no NCAA tournament this past March, just like we mentioned with Indian Wells being canceled, and the NCAA lost almost $400 million there, Patrick, $375 million with no tournament. You know, and there were a lot of stories like Rutgers was going to be in the tournament for the first time since 1991.
Right.
Obi Toppin, who's now with the Knicks, could have made a run to the Final Four with Dayton. Same with Miles Powell, who's now with the Knicks, and Seton Hall. So it's sort of heartbreaking as someone who covers a lot of those guys, those kids, that they didn't get to play. So there's a lot of money at stake this year. They are going to have an NCAA tournament. They're saying they're going to hold it in a bubble in Indianapolis, just in one city. But, you know, in the next 2-3 months, it'll be interesting. You know, some teams are going to play 25 games, and some teams are going to play 15 because of COVID.
Right, and you know what else is also heartbreaking, Adam, and you're absolutely right. I mean, not to mention kids that were either graduating from high school or college, just, you know, non-athletes, just any kids. But did you see the 60 Minutes piece last night? This was a Sunday night. This is, you know, the piece on the secondary sports, you know, going under at a lot of big-time programs. Minnesota, right, for example. Stanford cut 11 varsity sports. Tennis wasn't one of them, but tennis was one of the sports cut at the University of Minnesota, which is a big Big 10, or is it Big 12? I guess it's Big 10 still. You know, big, huge school.
Big 10, yeah. And UConn, I think, yep. UConn cut in tennis too, right?
Yes, and partly, and a big part of the reason is that because of, you know, the correlation between the Final Four March Madness not happening, so all those schools losing the revenue, and, you know, from basketball, obviously football and basketball are the revenue sources for all the athletic programs, but sports like fencing, you know, wrestling, swimming in some places. I mean, these are sports that produce Olympic athletes. I mean, when I went to Stanford, I mean, there were more Olympic athletes on the swimming team. You know, it was remarkable. Right. So anyway, that's another story. We can do a pod down that on that topic down the road. But it's been awesome.
I mean, I think if I could just say one thing, I just, you know, I think there's sort of conflicting interests here. Are on the one hand, you know, obviously people's health is the primary issue.
Yes.
And there's a whole contingent of people that say, look, you shouldn't be putting these student athletes in football or basketball or other sports at risk,
right,
by having them travel and play games at all. And on the other side of that is, there's a ton of money at stake in football and basketball, and B, there's, you know, a huge population of the segment of the American population that has to have their football, wants to see it, wants to see basketball, and it gives people a certain level of comfort and normalcy to have these sports being played during a pandemic, but, you know, you're also, you know, playing with people's lives to some extent.
Yeah, well, I think also the big, to me, the bigger reason that these sports are happening is financial. It's economic,
right,
because whether, even if it's ESPN that I work for or different networks, I mean, there's so much money involved in football and basketball. So we got to take the good with the bad. You know, you got to, if you get, you know, this is the way the college system works at the moment. You know, it's different in Europe. They don't have big time college, you know, athletics. If you're into whatever sport you're into, you try to become a professional, or you try to, you know, swim in the Olympics. If you're from Croatia, for example, or play on the national team, you don't go to college to do that. You do that in the U.S., which has attracted a lot of, you know, athletes in all sports, but particularly tennis, from different parts of the world. But we could go on and on that. We should at someday talk about that, because I find that a fascinating topic as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, the main thing is we just got to stay safe and do all the stuff, social distance, wear a mask that they advise, and hopefully we get through these seasons, and hopefully we get a vaccine here by, you know, sooner than later.
And we know that we can play tennis and be socially distanced, Adam. So you keep doing it down in Jersey. I'll keep doing it here in Westchester at our academy at Randall's Island. And we'd love to have you come there and pay us a visit anytime, too, as well.
It sounds good. And I'm looking forward to playing at Iona.
Exactly.
Set up a day with Nick Pitino.
You got it. Adam Zagori, everyone, on Holding Court.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.